This is the smell of the leftover tuna fish sandwich you left in your lunchbox over the weekend in a Wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, Wimpy, Wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a Hefty Ultra Strong trash bag.
Hefty, Hefty, Hefty!
Ah, smell the difference? Hefty Ultra Strong has Arm & Hammer with continuous odor control, so no matter what's inside your trash, you can stay one step ahead of stinky. And for bigger jobs, try the superior strength of Hefty Large Black Bags.
Hi, this is Johanna Rothman, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I am this episode's host, Jay Hersko, and joined with me is James Gifford. James, say hello.
Hello.
And our special guest this evening, who you can hear laughing in the background, is author speaker Johanna Rothman. Johanna, thank you for taking the time. We really do appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Fantastic. So, Johanna, in the chance that we have some listeners who aren't familiar with you or your work, you want to give us a quick bio, background, 30-second elevator pitch about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I write and speak and consult all about managing product development in all of those wonderful terms about getting projects done, managing programs, managing the project portfolio, management, all that stuff.
Great, great, great. So the reason why we're having Johanna on tonight is she has a book coming out, which is titled Create Your Successful Agile Project. So James and I wanted to get her on to discuss the book. We were luckily given an advanced copy, which I churned through trying to prepare for this interview. So we have a couple of things that I took gratuitous notes. I don't know about James, of things I wanted to talk about as we were going through it. So hopefully we have a really good conversation. So with that, let's begin. So the first thing I wanted to ask you, Johanna, is the title of the book itself is Create Your Successful Agile Project. And you can't trip and fall on Amazon without running into a book that talks about agile transformations, agile adoptions, making agile work for you. And yet nowhere do I remember seeing a title that says Agile Project. So what led you down this path? What was the impetus behind taking this approach versus the I've got a framework and an adoption transformation path to sell you?
So I believe in an agile approach to agile adoption or transformation. And the first way you start with an agile approach is to get a team that can successfully deliver all the features in a project. Right? Because you can't get to products until you can finish a project. So don't start with, you know, marathons or jumping 50,000 feet into the air. Start at the ground level. Start where you are and say, how can we possibly get this project going?
And I have my own opinion here, but I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. Who is the intended audience for this book?
So I've been teaching. This came out of a workshop that I have called something with the forgettable name of Agile and Lean Project Management. And I often have teams and project managers who are saying, you know, our execs really want us to do Agile. And we looked at Scrum and Scrum is good, but it's not going to work for us. And we don't understand all this Kanban stuff and how it works into a project. But we think we need something to do the, quote, agile, end of quote. So I was looking at the leaders in the organization, not necessarily managers, certainly not C-level people, although I think they could get a lot out of this book. But the idea is these are people who have the demands on them to actually deliver functionality via a project. So that's who I wrote this for. Agile project managers, scrum masters, coaches, some even technical leaders, because I think it's really important to say, how do we work together as a team and get this product out the door?
Now it's great. I think you hit the nail on the head. And when I started reading the book, the first thing I got about two or three chapters in, and I thought to myself, this isn't a book that I would give to a C-level executive. However, this isn't a book I would throw at someone who's in the trenches, who's a practitioner, someone who's on a team and says, oh, okay, we're going to try this new thing. Let's run with it. I did, and I'm going to give myself a little pat on the back here. I did interpret this as something, this is a book for someone who's in the middle and trying to figure out, hey, what I'm doing, this waterfall or whatever it is they may be, it's not really working. So this is a new way of thinking about, well, how do I make a change and how I do what I do in order to get better results? As we go through the agenda, I really like how you tied all of the chapters together, because it almost was almost like a narrative where you started with the discussion around iteration agile versus flow agile, which can be translated as Scrum versus Kanban. And the way that it almost read to me like the Phoenix Project, where you're taking us on a journey. You're taking the reader on a journey where they're walking through the different things that they're going to have to consider as they go through the motions of adopting an agile mindset and an agile delivery model.
Well, that's exactly what I was hoping. I'm so glad, actually. I was hoping that people would read it like that. I've been writing about agile approaches for a long time. I happen to use one-week iterations for my work, but I work in flow. So, and the iteration just provides me a cadence for planning and reflection. And I find that so many of my clients cannot even think about things don't stand still for 2 weeks. Trying to fit their work into a Scrum-like iteration, oh, they just get so frustrated. And then they throw it all away and say, no, we cannot possibly do it. And that's not very helpful. I would much rather say, what can we do? How can we make this work? And you don't have to actually have just Scrum. And Scrum is not the only way to do iteration-based Agile. And you don't have to have just Kanban. And Kanban is not the only way to do flow agile, although I really love the boards. So how do we find what works for us? And can I tell a story? Is that okay?
Oh, sure. Go for it.
Oh, good. Okay. So a recent client said, they called me up, and actually it was the director or the CIO or somebody who called me and said, I want the agile. But I don't want that. That's what he called it, the Agile, right? And I don't want, and he named all of the frameworks. I don't want the Scrum, and I don't want the Safe, and I don't want the Kanban, and I don't want this, and I don't want that. I mean, he didn't want any of that. And I said, okay, you've come to the right place, because I'm not religious about any of it, but I really want to help you understand what agile approaches might work for you. And he said, I got to get the agile. And then we had a conversation about what the agile was. But when I explained to him that, you know, can this particular team actually understand what they have to do for even a week at a time? And he said, nope, this team, nope. They have to be able to change every other day. I thought, oh, goodness. Well, there was a whole bunch of reasons for that. And then this other team, yes, they could plan for a week, but then they would have interruptions for the next week. So how do you, if you are a cross-functional team and you can start to work in an agile way, how can you take the best of both iterations and flow and say, how do I make my own agile? Not the agile, but my own. So it really works for me.
I'm going to be laughing about the agile. quite a bit.
Well, I mean, he's a really smart guy. And he actually said to me, I don't want to get into the life cycle wars. I said, okay, I don't want to get into the life cycle wars either. He said, I want my teams to be effective. I want them to produce product. I want them to do all the stuff that they think that they can do that we need them to do. I said, okay,
Great. So you just made a couple mentions about teams. And one of the things that I picked up on early in the book was when you were talking about forming a team, you touched on, you know, the idea of cross-functionality. And then there was a line around team members should manage their – teams should manage their own members, right? And just recently we had an interview with Sandy – we did an interview with Sandy Mamoli, who talks about self-organizing teams where you get everybody in a room and they start to – people start to pick out who they want to work with, and naturally, organically, that leads to these almost crazily cross-functional teams with all these different minds on there, which is not something that if you read the Scrum, you know, the Scrum Bible, that's not something that's described. That's not something that's called out explicitly, that everybody should be able to choose their own members. We just talk a lot about cross-functionality. That's almost not heretical, but it's almost a different way of thinking. Where did that come from?
So it might be a little heretical, except Sandy and I forget her co-author, actually wrote that book already. So I've been doing self-organizing teams because I realized that this worked better than me trying to tell people what would be on a team with, right? So part of my background, I was a project manager and a program manager for a number of years inside the organizations. I was a director level and a VP level inside also. And then I became a consultant. And I found that especially when I was a manager, it was much more effective for me if I said, here's this really interesting product, and we're going to have several projects about that. And here are the people, when I was managing testers, here are the developers working on that. Would you like to work with them? And because this is a long time ago, I'm an old programmer as opposed to a young manager. So I, you know, who would you like to work with? And then a few years later, I actually got requests from people that they had a couple of developers already. And they said, we want Jack as our tester. And if Jill could come with him, that would be even better. So I actually thought, you know, why am I trying to design teams? Why don't I let the teams figure it out? I also was a shepherd for an experience report. I'm going to say his name wrong, but it was, I believe it was Yiv Lee. And he actually got, I don't know, a couple hundred people in a big room in China and said, we need teams for this project and this project and this project and this project. Put yourselves together as teams. And they did in about 30 minutes. So I know. So if I realized, you know, I was a little too directive back as a manager, and that my colleagues and my clients were actually saying, you know, our people can figure out how to work together. Why not suggest it?
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I love it. So you've mentioned now a couple of times, and I'd like to unpack this one, the term agile project manager. So that technically is what I do. I have met a couple. Dogmatist, the idea of an agile project manager is like, you know, spitting in the face of their God. I've had a couple of arguments so far. So on the topic of agile project managers, I mean, is that term an oxymoron? Is it a necessary evil, or is it really a step towards something better? Is it a step towards where we need to go?
So I have described servant leadership in this book, and I have described servant leadership in the program management book. And back when I was a project manager and a program manager, I was a servant leader. I was a little more directive than I am now because I've learned something. But I was an agile project manager. I think that one of the things that people really liked about this about Scrum when it first started is that the idea of command and control people, where they said, where are you in relation to the Gantt chart, which is not what a project manager does. All right. That's a project manager in title, not the activities of a project manager. That all went away. And so I actually think that we have agile project managers. I just finished earlier this year collaborating on the Agile Practice Guide with people from the Agile Alliance and the PMI. We have the term project manager. Why not use it? And don't get me started on Scrum Master, right? That's like Uber and Chief. I mean, do not get me started because I'm going to rant and rave. So, which I guess I already did. So as far as I'm concerned, project managers facilitate the team. They serve the team. They protect the team, right? When management wants to do wacko stuff. So I think it's really important that we say Agile Project Manager is a real name. It's the step towards something much better than what we had, where you had an idiot with a Gantt chart, right? I mean, that's just nuts.
I've been called worse. I think I agree wholeheartedly. My personal feeling has always been, as long as you're in an organization that has the concept of a project, you will always need a project manager. To come in and blindly say, oh, well, we've got the Agile now, so we don't have PMs anymore. They're all now Scrum Masters, is one of the most almost self-destructive things I've seen done in an organization, because it's not to overload analogies and metaphors, but it truly does upset the apple cart in all sorts of directions. And you got people running for the hills.
And so I just want to kind of jump in on here too, because at the current transformation I'm working at, where we left the entire project management stack intact. We decided not to go convert them. And it's really working out to be something that's been pretty successful. They've become more of the grease in the wheels, where, you know, when the Scrum teams have impediments, the Agile project managers in our organization are the first line of defense to help run that down. And communicate to management why things are, you know, problematic or things that need to be resolved. And there's just an inherent set of skill sets that they have that most Scrum Masters that you find off the street that came from a development team or our QA, because we decided to promote them up from there, they're actually really what's keeping these projects that we're working on track. But from a different angle, there's less managing that Gantt chart and the schedule, and more just paving the way. So it's really cool to.
James, I feel like I've been talking nonstop for the last 15 minutes or so. Anything in particular that you noticed, mentioned, recall from the book you wanted to call out?
As somebody that, like, I have an extreme passion for product development, and so you kind of see the notion of the walking skeleton in your book, or and getting into the MVP or the MBE light. I think that's something that's extremely valuable. We've done a lot of different practices with like story mapping and things like that, and I think that you have an interesting approach that, you know, our listeners would really benefit from kind of going through that. So I'd love to hear you kind of unpack your thought process around that.
So I've been doing product owner workshops also. I know you're so surprised. So I've been thinking about and trying to work with people about what is the minimum that they could actually do. Because I see so many product owners where they say, we have to have it all or it's not useful. And if they want to release it for money, maybe they have to have it all or it's not useful. But when I start to say, well, what's the first thing that a customer would do? And that's for an MVP. And then maybe what kind of a hypothesis are you concerned about? Where do you want to experiment? What, instead of getting what's the first thing to business value, which might be your MVP, what do you want to know about? So you might not even have to go all the way over there for that part of the feature set. So one of the things I'm a firm believer in is I happen to not use the words epic or theme, because different tools use them differently. So I call everything a feature set if it has several stories in it. And then I ask, if you could carve up this feature set and say, what do I want to know about so I might not have to do, right? Because that takes time. That's where you want to do an experiment. And when I first started to work with a particular product owner, he said, oh, this team is really slow. They're never going to give me an experiment. He was like Eeyore. So I said, fine, why don't you do a spike, a one-day spike, and see what you get? Because if you can do a one-day spike, you actually know more about what the real MVP is, and you might have enough for an MVE. And he said, they'll never be able to do it. So I said, give them a chance, right? You just can't tell. And when he said, we were going to try a one-day spike and see what you get at the end of it. And here's the reason why. I want to know, can I carve out this part of the feature set that we don't need? Do I need to include this piece? What is it our customers really need? And that's when they said, oh, we can do that in a day. Well, they did, actually. And everybody was so surprised. So the fact that everybody was so surprised meant that it was a really good experiment. So they experimented in the team with their work. They were able to experiment with this particular set of features. They were able to experiment with all kinds of things. And that, because they got started with a one-day experiment, that allowed them to do a lot more experiments.
And I'm glad that you keep bringing up, you mentioned experiment a million times, and it's so important that people understand how to experiment. And I was working for a customer rebuilding their e-commerce platform, and they basically had like a 25% acceptance or adoption rate of their mobile application, and it was because it was abysmal. And we finally got the management and leadership to understand that we needed to send a designer and a developer and one of the product people to on site to kind of work with some pharmacists. And it was amazing to see that once you got to the talking to the customer and saw some of the scenarios of, how they were doing work, that the designer and the developer on the plane ride back from Texas, they literally came up with a rough design of the UI. The guy had an understanding of how he was going to code it. And they also found this really cool scanning software that the developer had saw at a trade show. And they brought that all back and they spent like a week working on it. And then they went back to Texas and put it in the customer's hands. And literally from that, week's worth of work, the customer's like, I would sign this. I will, get on and tell everybody about this new feature you have. And so they brought in the rest of the 60 people in the focus group, and literally all 60 of them were ready to sign that day for the next release of the product and the mobile application. 11 months later, when they finally launched, because they were just rebuilding the entire e-com platform instead of rolling it out bit by bit, they went to 98% of mobile adoption. So they completely just destroyed their goal of getting it up to 50%.
Wow.
And it was like two weeks of work for, just blowing your goals out of the work.
Yeah.
So the two stories that you've told us so far, Johanna, first about the gentleman looking for the Agile and the second about the technology spikes. And both those stories started out with people saying, no, that won't work because X. Mm-hmm. So is it a true observation that a lot of the times the biggest struggle that all of us practitioners, coaches, change agents, whatever, is the biggest hurdle trying to overcome really just the culture of the organization to go from a problem-centric way of thinking to a solution-centric way of thinking?
So I think that, I actually know this. Agile approaches are a total cultural change, right? That's really the key with Agile approaches. So it does not matter if you're using Kanban instead of Scrum. I mean, Scrum creates this, necessary change of culture because it just blows up everything. But even if you use Kanban, you need to have a cultural change of we work together because it's our job to work together for throughput. And we worked together to keep our technical excellence up. So it's easier for us to be able to do the work we want to do later. So in my experience, if you have not yet been able to work in a collaborative, cross-functional team, working on delivering features on a regular basis, then agile approaches feel so foreign. I don't think of it as a. What did you ask if it was a problem-centered approach to something else?
Yeah, problem-centric thinking, where when you give someone a scenario in the first, the knee-jerk reaction is, well, that won't work here because, and they rattle off 10 different reasons why. Whereas solution-centered thinking would be, I can see where that would be difficult. However, we could apply it in X manner, Y manner, right. Z manner. It's been my experience that the knee-jerk reaction is always saying, well, that won't work here. And even as someone who's been through my first transformation, I'll admit it. I'll come out of the confessional. I was not the guy drinking the Kool-Aid. I was, this sucks. Why are we doing this? And it's changed my life. So I can understand how people could come out with that almost not intrinsic, but at their cellular level, the rejection of the idea of doing this completely differently because it's almost bananas.
Well, and it challenges everybody's idea of self. So what are you rewarded on now? Your heroics, your deliverables, your personal stuff. And now we're asking you to change to being, it's all about the team and it sounds kind of kumbaya. I mean, give me a break. You know, I am a hard-boiled egg. I did not get into software development because I really liked people. I got into software development because I got to commune with a computer. It was the most fun I could ever imagine having. So, and I wish I could say, okay, I've been married for 33 years, and my husband actually says he has rubbed off all of my hard edges. So I don't have peaks and valleys anymore. I just have soft peaks and very large valleys. So, oh God, that was horrible. Oh well. But I am not a touchy-feely person. I mean, if anyone had said to me, your people at work that you work with are going to be kind of like family, I would have said, get me out of here. So, I mean, this is not why I come to work every day. I come to work every day to figure out how I can be successful and with my team, how can I be successful? So as a consultant, I have teams at various levels of the organization, and I find that very satisfying. But I think that when we ask people to change the basics of culture, we have to say to them, it does not have to be this one way. Here's our objective, right? We want to finish this feature. We want to finish the story. How can we do it so that we get the best possible story done in the shortest possible time? Not to say, we don't care about defects. We don't care about testing. No, no, no. We care about all that stuff. How do we get the best possible result from actually the least amount of effort and the least amount of time?
So now that we're talking about results, least amount of effort, least amount of time, which sort of segues us into our next topic. So you do have a chapter here, which I thought was brilliant, on technical excellence. And it's been a lot of coaches have shared the observation that it seems like nowadays there is so much emphasis put on quote unquote doing agile right or doing agile well that we forget that this all is bedrocked by technical excellence. So what good is delivering value in every 2 weeks if your code is crap or if the technical debt becomes insurmountable or you're not following good practices? And I thought that was a wonderful topic to include there, not only because it's relevant, because I think sometimes it's...
Well, I think that the problem with any of the frameworks is that I believe it's any of them. I don't know. Maybe I'm brushing everything with a broad brush and it doesn't deserve it. But certainly Scrum expects you to reflect and then in a retrospective say, you know, we need some technical practices. But I have found that if I don't say to the team that I'm working with and I don't say to the managers, you know, you can ask people not to do all of the test automation that they need to do. And then you will end up with no continuous integration. You will end up with code you cannot change. You will end up with a mess. I believe that Doc Norton calls it cruft. That is not technical debt. Technical debt is something you choose to take on. A mess is something that puppies make. And if you don't want puppies hanging around, then you expect your people to work as professionals where they develop tests for the code. They develop tests at the unit test level, at the system test level, everything in between. I mean, you know, if I had not been a developer, maybe I would not feel so strongly about this. But I was doing continuous integration back in the 70s. And the fact that it went out of fashion in the 80s makes me nuts. So, and how do you get to continuous integration? You have to have tests that support all of the code. Right, you have to have a wide variety of tests. You have to know, is the performance going to be okay if you change this thing? So for me, technical excellence is a huge, huge deal. And it's necessary for us as humans. We want to be proud of our code. We want to be proud of our tests. We want to be proud of our product. And the way we get that is with technical excellence.
Tests. Performance, all important things. I would love to pull you aside and spend a whole conversation about how continuous integration fell apart in the 80s and how it disappeared, because I think that'd be that's an episode in and of itself. I think that'd be fascinating on that rabbit hole, because it seems so – when it was presented to me, it seems almost counterintuitive – like not counterintuitive, but, well, this is common sense. Why wouldn't we want to check our code in more than once a month before we get ready to put it in prod? So yeah, that's a different story for a different evening. So later on in the book, you start digging into some of the meatier things that if I am trying to do an Agile project for the first time, I will have to step into. And this is where I was really fascinated. One of the parts one of the quotes here, lines I called out. I think it was page 156. You talk about creating approximate estimates for management. James, yep. And I'm sure you can say the same thing. We've probably all lost track of the amount of times someone has said, well, we're Agile now, so we can't give you a Gantt chart or a timeline of when it's going to be done. And it just makes you want to run for the hills. So this is something that really is necessary, but it seems like people use the Agile as a crutch and not want to give estimates. So can you give us a little bit more background on why you specifically call this out and its importance in doing this whole Agile project?
Sure. So I get asked for estimates all the time, right? Whether they're time estimates or cost estimates. And as a responsible professional, I have to provide these estimates. I believe that the story I talked about was driving, right? So if you want to get from point A to point B, which is the beginning of the project to the end of the project, what is an order of magnitude estimate? Now, the key is the managers cannot hold you to that estimate. It's an estimate. It's a guess. And it's not going to be accurate unless you actually know everything about the requirements and you know everything about the code and you know everything about the tests that exist or do not exist. So the problem is it's probably more than a back of the napkin, but it's an order of magnitude. And if you are willing to work and finish features on a regular basis, and I really like one day features, I really like it when the team says we can release something, even if it's only internally, every single day, that allows people to look at the product when they look at the product, they don't care as much about the estimates. But I don't know anybody in an organization who does not have to do some kind of rough estimate. So, excuse me, get over it, right? Do a rough estimate, but do not spend days estimating, right? So, I don't believe in iteration zero. I don't believe you can actually estimate the entire project in one iteration, because if you could, you should be actually be doing something in that iteration and releasing product at the certainly at the end of it, if not during it, so that people can see you are actually delivering value. So the problem is the estimate has no value as a project tool. It has value for management. And we have to get managers on our side. This business of we don't need managers, that's nonsense. It's just nonsense. We need the managers. We have to have them. Let's use them. Let's show them what we need them to do for us so that we have successful projects.
So you talk about it's a necessary evil because we do need managers and we have to feed into them. The next chapter right after that is talks about status reporting, which is another yeah. one of those things where I have heard, oh, well, we're not doing status reports anymore because we're agile. And that's quite honestly, that's horseshit. nobody goes home on a Friday, comes in on a Monday, flicks a light switch, and now we're all agile. There is that journey. There is that transformation. There is those steps. And part of those steps is eventually you transition your old status reports don't look like your new status reports, but there is still that concept of having to report out where we are as we sit today. And I thought that was great that you called that out, because that's one of the first things that people say, oh, we're going agile. Get rid of the project managers. No more status reports. No more Gantt charts. And it's like almost mind numbing. So I thought that was great that you called that out.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's even better, right? If you have, instead of counting points or nonsense like that, you can just count stories in a burn-up. You can count the product backlog burn-up chart. You can show where the delays in the system are. All of that is status, aside from working product, right? When you show working software, now you really have status. What I really want people to understand is We have real empirical data about the product. That is what all these other surrogate measurements were before. So why not measure the stuff that we want more of, which is features and progress, right? And in terms of features, stories done, and not points, because that's a surrogate measurement, and measure the stuff we want less of, which is defects and delays. And we can show people where we are. If we show people our work in progress, we can say, you know, we have a lot of work in progress here. We have a lot of stuff that's not released because we still have this artifact of the release team, and they're trying to release for 15 other teams. So they are really under the gun. When we say they are really under the gun, we're not blaming them. Yeah, this is what it is. So let's explain to people, this is what it is. Let's not get all involved in velocity and all that nonsense.
I love the – every time points comes up, the first thing I think of is I'm working my way through Dan Vacanti's book on actionable agile metrics, and he has a quote early on in the book that says something like, if you really want to end your career, go into your CIO's office and try to explain points. And it was something along those lines, but I sat there giggling because he's completely right. Trying to explain that, let alone use it as a metric of points comparison, is totally misplaced. And you're gonna open more ditches that you're gonna find yourself falling into. And James, I believe you were about to talk, and I cut you off again.
It's quite all right. So it's, you know, this whole estimation topic is just really crazy. And so thank you for going to go through that. I think with our status reporting, I think one of the most recent things we added to the status report that's really starting to change the conversation is the percentage of backlog items that are basically defects or unplanned work. And it's actually started a lot more conversations around the technical leadership and going, hey, why is this happening? So having the right status report is essential for communicating information. It's one of the reasons that we've been able to start having some of the different conversations around technical excellence. So, you know, I'm glad that you did not, you know, you included this because it is absolutely important. And, you know, kind of the kind of one of those tripping points though with status reporting and when we put different items on there is the reaction of middle management. And, you know, it's something that we're still struggling with, is installing out that frozen middle that we were always talking about. And, you know, are they the elephant in the room? How do we teach middle managers kind of, and I know you cover it pretty well in your book, but would love to hear some more thought process around like the middle managers and how to kind of help them change their mindset. We're getting ready to go through a whole training on what Agile is for, you know, functional managers, which in our organization is our middle management layer.
So if I go right to middle managers, I think that the biggest thing for them is they are often rewarded on resource efficiency. And agile approaches, regardless of the approach, is all about flow efficiency, right? How does the team get the feature, that story, from ready to done, regardless of what the board looks like? And if you have, and what I find is that middle managers, if they don't understand flow efficiency, and there's a great book that I reference in this, which is called This is Lean, I believe it's called, the subtitle is Resolving the Lean Paradox. I don't remember, but I'll send you the link to it. But it's a really important book, and it's a really important idea. If we reward people on individual work, and this goes for the managers, what possible incentive do they have to help a team work as a collaborative team? How can they advocate for team space? Right now, I actually said in the book, if I was the Empress of the Universe, every team would have a team space. In addition, people would have private offices. I realize I do not live in that world. On the other hand, if teams cannot create their measurements as they proceed through whatever flow they have, how can a team understand where they are? Right. So I want people to be able to work together as a collaborative team. They need space in which to do that. I want them to be able to see their data as a team, not individual data. If the manager is rewarded and measured on his or her individual work, how can that manager understand what to do for a team? So this is where if you do have a successful Agile project, I really mean successful, then you start bumping up against the culture of the organization. We need managers to help change that culture because managers reinforce culture. They are the holders of the culture. We need our managers to help us. Right, we need Agile project managers to facilitate the team and resolve impediments as much as they can. But we need managers to actually resolve the organizational impediments. And that's why it's so important for the managers to not be ignored, but to use them as the best possible people that they can.
That's great. That's fantastic. And I think that's probably the best spot for us to pick to end it. I know I want to be conscious of everybody's time. The hour is getting late. I know I'm actually past my bedtime. so Johanna, I wanted to give you a chance to share. Obviously, you can share some book details, but any upcoming speaking engagements, book tours, conference appearances, anything you have coming up that you'd like to give a plug for?
So I have a speaking calendar on my website. I'm doing a webinar about project metrics, Agile team metrics. I don't remember what they called it, something not not necessarily what I named it in January. It's on my website. And I know I will be at UberConf in July. And I am working on getting my teachable workshops up and running on a quarterly basis. I offer writing workshops so far, and I'm working on all the other workshops that I want to offer. So all of that will be on my speaking page, and I will send you that link.
Awesome. Great. And I will include that for the benefit of our listeners. I'll include that in the show notes, along with a link to your book. And Johanna, if users wanted to follow you on Twitter, get in touch with you, what are the best ways to do so?
So I'm at Johanna Rothman on Twitter. Everything is, if you go to jrothman.com, that's where everything is. All of my books, including the program management book and the project portfolio book and the estimation book, all that stuff. And I have been on a little bit of a Twitter diet because I am quite capable of spending too much time on Twitter. I know nobody ever does
never,
that.
Never.
So I've been really working on managing my Twitter time. I'm also on LinkedIn. I welcome the opportunity to link with any of your listeners. And I guess that's about it.
Great. Thank you. James, anything you need to shout out?
No, I'm pretty dry with the conferences this year. So, if anybody wants to find me, reach out to me. You can find me at @thescramando on Twitter. You can check out my blog at scramando.com.
Thank you, James. And once again, I'm your host, Jay Hursko. You can find me on Twitter at @BackdoorAgile, and you can find me bouncing around the coalition. So on behalf of James and myself, Johanna, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to sit with us. It's really been a pleasure. We will definitely have you on again. And on behalf of the three of us, I would like to thank all of our listening audience for tuning in. If you like what you heard, please give us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcasting platform of choice. And you are well welcome to subscribe. We love hearing from our subscribers. And if you want to join the discussion, please hop on to coalition.agileuprising.com. It's free, it's open, and there's a lot of good conversation going on. And last but not least, you can support us if you'd like by becoming a patron for as little as 25 cents a show. I'll have the updates in our show notes for a link to Patreon. But once again, thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and we will chat again soon.